Downloads of this show are available on Podomatic.com and the Podomatic mobile app.
Listen, all you New Yorkers.
Hello. I hope no one's eating dinner.
Something like that.
What's up, everybody? It's 10 o'clock on Monday night, which means it's time for the next best thing.
Dear Jesus.
I'm your host, Jonathan B. Lerner, and I'll be with you for the next 2 hours.
Well, get ready.
Don't go anywhere. We have a great, 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 great show lined up for you tonight.
I can't even contain myself.
But before we get to any of that, we'd like to kick the show off by doing what we always do, and that is review all of the great and the not-so-great things that have happened on...
This Day in History.
Today is October 23rd, and on this day in history, in 1915, approximately 25,000 women demanded the right to vote with a march in New York City. On this day in 1925, Johnny Carson was born. In fact, to honor the great Johnny Carson, today is officially National TV Talk Show Host Day. How have you been celebrating? And lastly, on this day in 2001, Apple Computers publicly announced their portable music digital player called the iPod. And get this, today is National iPod Day. Oh my God, did you know it fell on National TV Talk Show Host Day? I didn't. How could we possibly let that happen? How am I going to celebrate? I mean, I had my National TV Talk Show Host party planned for months. Son of a bitch, what am I going to do? I don't know. Killing time, reclaiming my time. Okay, bye. That's what happened on this day in history. And who knows, perhaps we'll make history right here tonight on Radio Free Brooklyn and be studied for years to come. But who are we kidding? Probably not. You're listening to the next best thing. Stay tuned. Oh, yeah.
Holy sweet mother of God, it is 10 o'clock on a Monday night, so you know what that means. Is it time for your favorite show ever?
No!
But it is time for the next best thing. I'm your host, Jonathan B. Lerner, keeping you company every Monday night from 10 until midnight right here on Radio Free Brooklyn. Can you hear me? 1 second. Testing. 1, 2, 3. Are we on? Great. Before we get into what's going on in the news, what's going on in the world, let's do the housekeeping that we always have to take care of. Let's just get it out of the way right off the top. You can tweet at us. We are at Next Best Radio. That's at Next Best Radio. Go ahead and like us on Facebook. Follow us on Facebook. A lot of stuff gets posted on our Facebook page, stuff that we talk about in any given episode, information, links to pertinent sites, all that stuff usually goes up on our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/NBT Radio. Also, if you're really feeling like you want to go all out and write, it's more than 140 characters, more than something you'd feel comfortable posting on a Facebook wall, you can always feel free to send us an email. We are at nextbestthing@radiofreebrooklyn.org. And lastly, we do ask you to remember that we are fully listener and producer supported. If you like what you hear on Radio Free Brooklyn, if you like what you hear tonight, please consider going to our website, going to this show's page, and donating a little something-something to keep us in business. If you like what you hear tonight, well, a donation could ensure that you will get to hear more next week and the weeks after that. If you feel so inclined, you can go to rfb.nyc/NBT. Again, that's rfb.nyc/NBT. Oh, man, that was exhausting, wasn't it? It was for me. I'm sure it was for you, too. So, that's all the housekeeping I can think of right now. If I've forgotten anything...
Nobody cares.
Good. Tonight's the night that we're going to make it happen, as I say all the time. We always make it happen right here for you on Radio Free Brooklyn. Tonight's the night we actually are going to continue with our October series of things that go bump in the night. Eerie, spooky, haunted, ghostly things, all things Halloween related. Because it's still October, the witching month, the witching hour. And it's time to talk about, continue talking about things that go bump in the night. Okay, enough. Thank you, Vincent. That was Vincent Price. The late, great Vincent Price. Give me 1 second.
Good. Hello. Can anybody hear me? This is great. This is a good show.
Hello, I'm back. I apologize. This is going well. Okay, folks, here we go. In the news, a school cancels Halloween because it's, quote, not inclusive of all students. Oh, yes, you heard me correctly. Boyden Elementary School in Walpole, Massachusetts, has decided to cancel Halloween because, quote, it can be difficult for many students, end quote. Instead, they're going to celebrate Black and Orange Spirit Day. Oh, I'm sorry. I just threw up in my mouth a lot. Quote, also, the parade is not inclusive of all students, and it's our goal, each and every day, to ensure that all of our students' individual differences are respected, the school's principal said in a letter, according to CBS Boston. Now, there's still going to be Halloween parties after school hours, but Halloween itself is going to be Black and Orange Spirit Day, according to CBS. And to that I say,
has the whole world gone crazy?
What's wrong with you people?
Seriously, this is a perfect example of what I like to call creating a problem where a problem doesn't exist. This is insane. Truly. First of all, Halloween's not inclusive enough? What holiday is as inclusive as Halloween? There's no religious affiliation. You don't have to be Jewish, Christian, Muslim. Everyone can celebrate Halloween. It's a secular, fun holiday. There's nobody excluded. How could it not be? How could it be any more inclusive? Number two, you're still going to celebrate
Black and Orange Spirit Day?
Who? No, come on. What?
Then what the f*** is this all about? What is this all about? Halloween is not a religious holiday. Everyone is invited and everyone is more than welcome and certainly encouraged to participate. And they're still going to be doing it. This is creating a problem where a problem doesn't exist. What is wrong with us? What is wrong? What kind of society do we live in? Truly.
Completely insane.
How is there nothing else to be thinking about at Boyden Elementary School in Walpole, Massachusetts? I mean,
Black and Orange Spirit Day?
No, such a thing doesn't exist. I'm all for the happy holidays. I'm all for including all of the, you know, Kwanzaa, Hanukkah, Christmas, whatever. This is not a problem. This is not a real problem. This is not a problem. This is made up. Do you disagree with me? I'd love to hear why you are an idiot.
Moving right along.
Tonight, we're going to talk about death. Yes, you heard me. Death. Actually, it's funny because the things we're going to talk about, they really aren't that scary when it comes to death. But we're going to talk about death and then what? What comes after? That's a question no one can really answer because anyone who knows, obviously, is dead. But there's wide speculation on the subject. God knows. Everyone has an opinion. Everyone has their belief system, and that's great. I firmly believe that, well, I don't actually know. I can't say I believe. That's the thing. When I debate this topic with friends of mine, there was one in particular, let's call this friend of mine Michael. His name's not Michael, but let's call him Michael. I don't know if he wants me to use his real name, so we're going to call him Michael. Well, Michael and I, we were sitting out in the East Village one day debating the afterlife and ghosts. Do we think there's anything after this life? When you die, what happens? Anything?
and he was debating the no, and I was debating yes, but not really. Here's the thing. I think I won this debate for one reason. He's a very smart guy, a very good debater. But we were, I think my word choice is what did it. I use the word hope. I can't say I believe something happens. I can't say I have faith that something specific happens, because the truth is, I don't know. How could I know? I've never died. And none of us know. So anyone who claims to really know what happens when you die is either silly or stupid or dead. And in that case, they ain't talking to you, most likely. So I use the word hope. I can't say I know what happens. I can't say I think what happens. I say I hope this happens. What I have always pictured the afterlife being is literally whatever you thought it was. If you think that heaven is going up to the pearly gates, wearing a white robe, having a golden harp, and praying for the rest of eternity, if you think that's heaven, then when you die, that's what you will experience. Personally, that, to me, sounds more like hell. So I always imagined heaven being literally you have the power to be with and wherever you want to be at any given time. If you want to be in the mountains of Colorado on a beautiful summer day to go on a hike, all you have to do is close your eyes, picture it, and you're there. You open your eyes and there you are. If you want to be with your dad or your mom or your long-lost aunt, you just think hard about them, picture wherever you want to be with them, open your eyes, and you're both together. That's my type of heaven. Do I think that's what happens? No, I just said I can't use that word. I hope that's what happens. Now, there was a book written by David Eagleman. He's actually a neuroscientist, and he's written many books, but one of the books he wrote was called Some, Tales from the Afterlives. Yes, that's right. He basically takes you through 40 different versions of the afterlife, 40 different possibilities. This is not a scientific book. As I said, he is a neuroscientist, but this book is all speculation and I would say fictional. For example, here's one part of the book in which he describes basically three types of death. So basically, this is the description of one of his afterlives, but in it, they describe the three different stages of death. This excerpt is actually read by the actor Jeffrey Tambor. You might know him from What's the name of that show? I was going to say Transamerica. That's not right. He's in a show. Okay. Here we go. This is an excerpt from David Eagleman's book, Some, on the three types of death.
There are three deaths. Now, the first is when the body ceases to function, of course. And the second is when the body is consigned or, put in the grave. The third is that moment sometime in the future when your name is spoken for the last time. So, you wait in this lobby until the third death. And there are long tables with coffee and tea, cookies. You can help yourself, and there are people here from all around the world. And with a little effort, you can strike up some convivial small talk. Just be aware that your conversation could be interrupted at any moment by, we call them the callers. And what they do is they broadcast your new friend's name to indicate that there will never again be another remembrance of him by anyone on the earth. Your friend slumps, saddened, even though the callers, they tell him kindly, look, you're off to a better place. The thing is, no one knows where that better place is or what it offers, because no one exiting through that door has returned to tell us. And tragically, many people leave just as their loved ones arrive, since the loved ones were the only ones doing the remembering, and we all wag our heads at that typical timing. Now, not everyone is sad when the callers shout out the next list of names. On the contrary, some people beg and they plead. These are generally the guys who've been here a long time. Too long. Take that farmer over there who drowned in a small river 200 years ago. Now get this, his farm is the site of a small college now. And the tour guides each week tell his story. So he's stuck. He's miserable. The more his story is told, the more the details drift. He's utterly alienated from his name. It's no longer identical with him, but it continues to bind. And that cheerless woman across the way is praised as a saint, even though the roads in her heart, believe me, were complicated. And I guess that is the curse of this room. Because since we live in the heads of those who remember us, we lose control of our lives and become who they want us to be.
How sad is that? It's true, what they want us to be. What makes me sad about that interpretation is just the idea that basically, as long as you're remembered, you're trapped in this waiting area. But not only that, but you have to basically be forgotten in order to be free. Well, who wants to be forgotten? Completely forgotten? Who wants to get to the point where no one ever says your name ever again? It's sad. I mean, that is so sad. And that makes me wonder, well, will we, I mean, unless you're George Washington, unless you're, I don't know, unless, but that's not even true. I mean, like, we all have great uncles, great aunts and whatnot, who every occasionally their names will come up, even if it's just on, you know, ancestry.com. So technically no one's ever completely forgotten. Right? But it is an interesting interpretation. That was from David Eagleman's book, Some Tales from the Afterlives. And frankly, that story, that waiting room scene, it reminded me of one of my favorite scenes from one of my favorite movies. Say it three times, Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice.
You want a cigarette?
Oh, no.
Trying to cut down myself. Is this what happens when you die?
This is what happens when you die. That is what happens when he dies. And that is what happens when they die. It's all very personal. And I'll tell you something. If I knew then what I know now, I wouldn't have had my little accident.
Maitland, how do you do? Take the handbook and go to the sixth door.
Oh, we forgot our handbook.
Come on.
Well, if you, that wasn't a good one to play on the radio because it's mostly visual, but they were in a waiting room and they were dead, obviously. And hopefully you've seen that movie so you could picture it in your mind. Okay, let's move right along here. So, really, I said this from the get-go and it's true and it's kind of an affliction that sticks with all of us our entire lives. And that is, we just don't know. It's the not knowing that can drive some people crazy. We don't really know what happens when you die. We don't know if anything happens when you die. A lot of people have tried to do experiments, to do something to come up with some kind of way to prove that something happens, something or other happens, but no one's really been successful. However, author and journalist Mary Roach, she wrote of one particular case where
two people banded together and did an experiment, trying and feeling confident that they would prove the existence of an afterlife. Here is that story. Here is that particular case. I find it very interesting, kind of sad.
Proof. Physical evidence that there is a beyond.
So here's what happened. One day, when was this, by the way?
This was 1921.
One day in 1921, Thomas Lynn Bradford,
the spiritualist who lived in the early part of the 1900s,
put out an ad.
Yes, he put an ad in a Detroit newspaper.
Which basically said, I would like to prove the existence of the afterlife. Anyone out there that can help?
I'm looking for other like-minded people to think about this. And this one woman contacted him.
Really?
A Ruth Moran.
Who was apparently a psychic.
And the two of them sat down and they devised what they thought was an ironclad plan. One person dies, crosses over to the afterlife.
And then from the beyond, that person would yell back.
Hey, it worked. I'm here. There's an afterlife.
Meanwhile, the person who didn't die would be sitting in a room somewhere, psychically listening. See if they could hear something.
Because if they could, then we'd have our proof.
Huh.
In fact, I think it was that evening, Thomas Lynn Bradford, in his rented room, he turned on the gas with the pilot off and asphyxiated himself. The New York Times reported this whole thing.
Detroit, February 6th. Thomas Lynn Bradford committed suicide last night. His body was found in his room at 2500 Howard Street with the gas turned on.
The landlord in his building found him the next day.
Nearby were found several typewritten pages on Can the Dead Communicate with the Living? Somewhere in Detroit is believed to be a girl who is waiting for him to answer this question.
The girl, of course, was Ruth Moran, the psychic, and there she was, across town in her own small apartment with the lights off, as I imagine it, just waiting.
Listening. But she didn't hear anything from Thomas Lynn Bradford.
Detroit, February 7th. Though more than 40 hours have elapsed, no message has come back from the spirit world to Mrs. Ruth Doran.
There was a follow-up story the next day. The headline said, Dead spiritualist silent. It was almost like when somebody is lost at sea. They wait a certain amount of time, and then they finally say, okay, we're declaring him dead.
Yeah. But you know what's weird? Is like this Ruth girl, right? Why wouldn't she just lie and say that she did hear Thomas Lynn Bradford?
I know, that's...
I think it's very admirable of her to be honest like that.
I think that people like Thomas Lynn Bradford and Ruth Moran, they weren't trying to pull a hoax. They weren't charlatans. They really were just seekers. They really just wanted to find proof.
Huh. But you said in that thing I read, you set him up as being the guy who knows, the guy who found proof. Were you just being colorful when you wrote that?
No, I mean, he knows in that he's dead now.
I see.
Dead people know.
So this isn't really like a knowing problem. It's a journalism problem.
It's a reporting problem. Billions of people know. They just can't get the answer back to us.
Huh.
I guess that's true, but that's a little shitty to do that. To be like, yes, we have proof. He does, but we won't know it because he can't tell us. Sorry. So that means we don't have proof. But isn't that, God, now that's a true story. Thomas Lynn Bradford really did that in the 20s. They really were like, okay, we're going to do this plan together. I'm going to go back home, kill myself. Don't worry. I'll be fine. And I'm going to communicate with you. Okay, you wait here. You're pulling for him. You want him to be able to get back to her. Because talk about a permanent solution to a temporary problem. Usually you hear people say that in reference to suicide. But this, I mean, come on. Like, if it doesn't work, oh, shit, I don't know. You get it. Okay, I'm going to take a little turn here. I was going to switch gears for just a second. There's an experience I've had a few times in my life that is terrifying. And I didn't know there was a name for it. But the first time I ever experienced it was in college. I was dating someone, and I was actually at their apartment. I'll never forget it. We were in their room. They were actually up doing homework on their computer. And I had fallen asleep, not in bed, but on their bed. And I remember that I was asleep, and suddenly I remember waking up, and I could hear them moving about the room, typing on their computer, you know, like folding laundry and stuff. I was awake, but I couldn't open my eyes, and I couldn't move. I was paralyzed. And I started to get this like panicky feeling. It was, I was awake. I could hear what was going on around me, but I couldn't move. And then I got this awful kind of foreboding feeling that somebody else was in the room. Someone else was kind of coming for me. I felt like I could sense this dark, evil presence, shadowy figure walk into the room and come towards me like they were going to take me or something, or hurt me. And I couldn't move. And I just remember lying there on the bed thinking to myself, I just remember specifically thinking, I did two things. I remember trying to yell out for my friend's name, couldn't do it. And I also remember just trying to somehow jerk, like, you know how like sometimes when you're falling asleep and you're kind of half in dream world but half awake, and so you're starting to dream, and you dream that you like fall off a curb, and so in real life you actually like kick your leg. That's what I was trying to make happen somehow. I was just, because again, you know, or think about when like your foot falls asleep, you know, you can still work to move your toes a little bit. You just have to really try. Well, that's what I was trying so hard to put all my focus, all my energy, and just get myself to like wake up, move my arm, jerk my leg or something. Couldn't do it. And it was the scariest thing that I thought had ever happened to me. I mean, I didn't know what it was. It was something so surreal. I found out probably like 2 years later that that's actually something that happens to people. It's happened to a lot of people. There's a name for it. And a lot of times people's experiences are much worse than mine. I told you I had that foreboding feeling and I felt like a shadowy figure was entering the room. Well, some people have gone so far as to feel like they were actually abducted by aliens. They actually felt like they were taken. They were moved. They were taken out of their apartments, out of their houses, into some vessel and abducted. Thank God that didn't happen to me. But this whole experience is something called sleep paralysis.
Hypnosis may be the key to recovering so-called memories of abductions. But another brain phenomenon may be responsible for kickstarting the idea in abductees' minds to begin with. It's called sleep paralysis, and it's a true waking nightmare.
I was held down by these living sort of ribbons that came across me and tightened up around me and bound me down. And then, of course, the aliens filed into the room and levitated me and took me out of the room. And it was a very bizarre experience. And I thought, I'm being abducted. You know, why? Why am I being abducted? What are they doing? Turns out I was just having sleep paralysis.
When we dream, our brain switches off our ability to move so that we don't injure ourselves acting out those dreams. When we wake up, it switches us back on again. But sometimes the switch is out of sync, and we wake up paralyzed.
Brain,
Brian Sharpless, a clinical psychologist at Penn State, specializes in sleep paralysis research.
Sleep paralysis is the experience of either falling asleep or waking up and you find that you're paralyzed. But you have some degree of conscious awareness and your eyes are still able to move and you can look around the room. It's often a terrifying experience for people that are suffering from it, not only from the paralysis, but because of the hallucinations that often accompany it.
The hallucinations vary, but come in three general types. First, the intruder, an evil presence approaching. Second, the incubus, something pressing on your chest, choking or assaulting you. Finally, levitation, the sensation of being lifted off the bed and even transported elsewhere. Put them together and you may have something strikingly familiar to a sleep researcher acquainted with UFO abduction stories.
I think all three categories are consistent with what people who report being abducted by aliens experience, having a presence in the room, feeling if someone's on top of you, sexually assaulting you, or potentially levitating you.
Sleep paralysis is thought to be responsible, down through the ages, for numerous terrifying nighttime visitations.
Where one time or place might find witches, demons, ghosts, and spirits as an explanation for sleep paralysis, it's possible that 21st century Americans might find technologically advanced aliens as an explanation.
This, an explanation? No, I don't know what that's supposed to mean, but it's interesting because sleep paralysis has happened to me a few times since that first story that I told. And in a way, usually, here's the thing. It's interesting. I don't know where I read this somewhere, but I read that sometimes it can be induced by like extraneous noise and whatnot and activity that's going on around you while you're falling asleep. For example, I go to sleep. This is bad. Don't do this if you don't, or don't ever. I know this is bad, so don't give me any crap. But I usually go to sleep with either a podcast playing or, you know, a playlist of YouTube videos or something. I need something playing. I need to fall asleep to something. And usually it's like a news report or something that I'm actually listening to. It's not just, you know, soft music or white noise. It's actually like Rachel Maddow telling me about the current state of the Russia investigation, meaning it's something that I'm actually listening to and paying attention to. And when you do that, it's basically something that that right there, just paying attention to what someone is saying and trying to follow along, wanting to hear what they have to say, that keeps you in the waking world, even as you're falling asleep. And that can induce that specific phenomenon where you are asleep. Your body has basically fallen asleep, but the part of your brain that is supposed to stop you from, or that that stops you from moving around while you're dreaming, well, that has been triggered. You're not quite asleep, but that part's been triggered, so you can't move, even though your brain is awake and aware. And when it happens now, it's still a terrible feeling because you just feel so helpless. But I at least know, even when it's happening, I kind of know it's happening and I kind of go into that panic mode again and I start jerking around just trying to do anything to wake myself up because it's a scary feeling. And those hallucinations that they refer to where you feel like you're in danger, you feel like there are just evil entities around. You don't want that feeling. It's a terrible feeling and you can't stop that feeling. I can't stop that feeling deep inside of me when I got sleep paralysis. But anywho, the reason I bring up sleep paralysis is because the more I learn about it and the more I kind of come to understand it, the more it sounds to me like what it might be like to be in a coma. That's what I've always pictured. Even before I ever heard of sleep paralysis, knew of sleep paralysis, or had experienced sleep paralysis, I used to always think that when someone was in a coma, they were likely able to hear us and were likely aware of what's going on around them. They just couldn't communicate necessarily. They couldn't speak. They couldn't move. And that's scary because I'm sure you've heard of a lot of cases where people are
kept on life support for a certain amount of time. They stay in a coma, and eventually their family just cuts the cord and they die. Well, what if they are conscious? What if they are conscious? Can you imagine that? Can you imagine if you were lying there in bed, unable to move and talk and communicate, but you were alive, you were aware, you were awake in your own mind, and you could hear the doctors talking to your spouse or your parents being like, "Well, there's nothing I can do, Mr. and Mrs. Robinson. We've done all we could. She's gone. I'm sorry." And they decide to cut the cord right there in front of you, and you're just like screaming out on inside, and you're like, "No, like, don't kill me." How terrifying. Well, I learned recently that I'm right about that. That is possible. Here is Dr. Adrian Owen, a neuroscientist at the University of Cambridge, telling an important story about a certain patient of his that came in. Well, I'll let him tell it.
This patient he had.
A patient who's in her 30s, and she came to us after 5 months in a vegetative state following a blow to her head.
So for 5 months, she'd been lying in the hospital.
Couldn't talk or couldn't move.
She could breathe, but
no evidence of any awareness.
You could shine light in her eyes. She wouldn't have the normal response. In effect, that woman was gone.
That's right.
But in spite of the fact that she was giving the world nothing back, Dr. Owen wondered, would it just be possible that there was somebody in there?
So we tried a new kind of approach with her.
Because they had a new and sophisticated tool that previous scientists had never had.
You mean a brain scanner?
Yeah, this is a stethoscope for the brain. Dr. Owen stood by her bedside and said, "Tell you what, in a few minutes, we're going to take you to a machine. You chat with her? You say, hey..."
Well, that's exactly how it's done. Yes, it sounds a little bit bizarre because, of course, you don't get any responses back from these patients. You don't even know whether they can hear you. But we make the instructions very clear.
And he says, "Now, when we put you in the machine, there's going to be a click, and I'm going to say into your ear, please begin..."
To imagine playing a vigorous game of tennis.
What?
We said, "Imagine that you're standing there at the baseline at Wimbledon carrying out the movements."
Tennis?
See, because why? Here's the thing. We now know enough about brains to know that if you are imagining tennis,
that will produce activity in your motor cortex, very similar to the activity that you would see if you could scan somebody when they were actually playing a game of tennis.
And this is true of all healthy people.
That's right.
Always the same pattern?
Yeah.
It lights up very reliably.
Okay, so he puts this patient into a brain scan.
He rolls her into the machine.
And we say, "Right, play tennis. Now relax. Play tennis. Now relax."
And you said this woman's been vacant for five months?
Yeah.
I gotta say, this seems quite literally a shot or a forehand in the dark.
This was his first patient.
Really?
He does this. He says, "Play. Stop. Play.
Play tennis.
Stop." She hadn't spoken or shown any sense of awareness or any interior life at all for months and months and months and months.
And?
"Play tennis."
On the screen, there's a tennis game.
What we saw is exactly what we see in healthy volunteers. Her premotor cortex was turning on and turning off when we asked her to relax. Turning on when we asked her to do the task, and it would stop when we asked her to relax.
So she's in there.
She's in there. Were you amazed, or were you expecting? What were you? What happened to you?
Well, I mean, it was pretty exciting. I mean, I have to say, the fact that it was the first person we tried it in was perhaps the biggest surprise. And we've scanned about 20 patients since then, doing the same thing. And we've seen three so far who showed clear signs of being aware.
That is effing terrifying. So how many did he say? Say that again, sir. Dr. Adrian Owen.
Well, it was pretty exciting. I mean, I have to say, the fact that it was the first person we tried it in was perhaps the biggest surprise. And we've scanned about 20 patients since then, doing the same thing, and we've seen three so far.
Okay, so they've scanned 20, and three were conscious, three were aware, but you would never know it without this experiment. So that horrifying scenario that I explained before playing this story, this clip, that's probably happened a number of times. Oh, can you imagine? Oh, I can't even. You're sitting there. You're thinking, Mom, Dad, you know, honey, my wife, my husband, whatever. I'm here. I'm here. Please don't kill me. But the doctor has said, we've done all we can do. And they probably pull the plug. I mean, that is a really, truly terrifying thought. And I will say this, excuse me. I will say this. They go on to talk about that very, very notion, that idea that so people have probably been conscious in a coma and killed. And they talk about it. If you want to find out what all they have to say about that topic, well, you can go listen to that entire show. That cut came from Radiolab. You can find those podcasts on the Apple Store and all that stuff. It's an NPR show, and I believe that episode is called Afterlife. Yes, I believe that's what it's called. Now, we spoke earlier about David Eagleman, the neuroscientist who wrote that story, Three Stages of Death, where you're not truly gone until the last time someone says your name, you remember. Well, he actually has another, he's in the same book, I believe, he proposes a theory, something that he thinks will happen in his lifetime. And I have to say this because it's true. This is something that I've actually thought about since the fifth grade or so, when I was in fifth grade in like 1999 or 2000. And so that was, you know, American Online was big. Computers were really becoming, we were entering the computer age, the digital age. And so this notion did cross my mind, especially since I had just, especially after my dad died. That was in the sixth grade. But it's amazing. When I heard this, I couldn't believe that he was talking this way, because this is something that I just kind of created in my mind as a fantasy, and I had never heard anyone else speak of. How about you? Here's his theory. Here's what he thinks could happen in the very near future. It's an afterlife. It's a type of afterlife that is kind of induced, created by people in Silicon Valley.
I think this is something I'll actually see in my lifetime. So the idea is silicon immortality. In other words, downloading your consciousness into a computer and will really have reached a new point where there'll be immortality.
How would you figure this would work?
So imagine you make an exact copy of the three-dimensional structure of the brain, all the neurons, all the connections between the neurons, the proteins inside, the phosphorylation states of the proteins. You make a copy of this whole thing. What matters is the algorithms that are running on top of the brain. It's not the wet, gushy stuff that matters. It's what that wet, gushy stuff is implementing. And the idea is that if you could recreate the brain out of, let's say, beer cans and tennis balls, and you get all the structure the same, and it runs the same algorithms, then that would be you. It would have your consciousness, your memories, your thoughts, and so on. Now, right now, it's science fiction because it's so much data, our current computers couldn't handle it.
Is that the only limitation, just the hard drive size?
There's other limitations.
Well, there are two limitations right now. One is our imaging technology, and the other is the amount of storage capacity.
And error. I mean, you get one atom or two wrong, and all of a sudden, instead of your cat named Coco, it's now named Boco, and then you're not the same person.
No, that's not true, in fact, because every time you hit your head on a cabinet, you're actually killing lots of neurons, but that doesn't change who you are. You don't misremember your cat's name. I mean, imagine that you changed one word in the novel Moby Dick. It would still be Moby Dick.
Well, it'd be almost Moby Dick.
It would be almost Moby Dick, but you are almost the same person day to day, and you're never exactly the same person that you were yesterday.
I suppose that's true. But notice the first thing he said. What was the first thing he said?
I think this is something I'll actually see in my lifetime.
Now, I don't know how old he is, but he sounds like a middle-aged man. He thinks this is really going to happen. I mean, what? I don't know how to be honest, I said that I thought of this and I thought maybe it would be possible. I didn't necessarily mean uploading your entire consciousness, like actually after you die, becoming some kind of computer chip. I was actually, my idea was that you could upload your memories. I guess that's the same thing though, isn't it? Your memories are everything you know. Idiot. But, okay, so let's say that does happen. Let's just assume, let's say in 30 years, we're suddenly uploading the brains of all of those we've loved and lost. Well, what does that mean? So then what? Are they a computer program? Like, how do they exist that way? I mean, think about it. Our consciousness, we are able to call friends and say, hey, let's meet at Taco Bell for dinner, and then we'll go see a movie. Then you actually physically go and meet them at Taco Bell at a certain time. You order food. You get the food and you eat it. You put it in your mouth. You chew it. You swallow it. You digest it. How could you do that having been uploaded to a computer screen? I mean, how would it work?
So the idea is, if we can recreate a brain in zeros and ones on a computer, then you could actually live inside of a virtual world. And you could enjoy living in this world indefinitely.
Indefinitely. So the afterlife would be a virtual world that we create where you're immortal? And he said, again, I'm going to play it one more time.
I think this is something I'll actually see in my lifetime.
That's pretty cuckoo, cuckoo, cuckoo. Or is it? Tweet at us, Next Best Radio. Do you think that sounds like a great idea? A scary idea? I don't know how I feel about it. To be honest, I mean, I don't know. I really don't know. You live in a virtual world? Well, isn't the whole point to be able to continue to have relationships and connections with those you love? I don't even, could you? Like if my dad, for example, he died when I was 12, if he was in this virtual world, could I still communicate with him? How? By typing? I don't know. I just don't know how I feel about that. I don't know. But it's a possibility. It's a possibility. It's a theory. These are all just theories because, as I said, no one knows. We just don't know. But one thing we do know, because people have actually lived to talk about them, are what is called near-death experiences. Now, people who have had these, you know, they say they're so powerful and they, more than anything, they seem to convince people that there is something after this life. Something. Because they were lifted from their body. They could see their whole, you know, medical team working on them. It sounds pretty amazing, to be honest. But over the years, you've heard various doctors and scientists explain all of it away. You know, explain every part of a near-death experience through some kind of brain science or, you know, neurological activity. Here's an example. Here's basically how near-death experiences work. And you'll hear them explained away one by one, the various parts.
The patient had lost too much blood. Her organs weren't getting enough. We really didn't think we could save her.
Because Christina's heart has stopped pumping, many would consider her dead. Yet something seems to be happening with her mind.
Das nächste, was ich wieder weiß, ist, ja, dass ich wohl unter der Decke.
Next thing I know, I was hovering underneath the ceiling of the room. I could see down on myself laying on the operating table. And I saw the surgeons and heard them talking to each other. The scenario was pretty hectic. I realized that this was about life or death.
To help understand near-death experiences, some researchers focus on the content of these episodes.
A common element that occurs early in near-death experiences is what's called an out-of-body experience. At that time, the person seems to be able to see and hear things going on, but up from the vantage point above their body. Often what they describe are the doctors frantically trying to bring them back to life.
Medical science has an explanation for what's happening to Christina.
A near-death experience to a neurologist is first and foremost a crisis. Christine's brain was in a severe state of crisis. The switches in her brain that control consciousness malfunction. And it enters a very unusual, a strange borderland of consciousness where it blends waking consciousness with REM dreaming consciousness.
As they leave the body, they begin to traverse this connection. They begin to travel from what this life is to what there would be beyond this life, after this life, outside of this life.
I can't exactly describe how I got from floating under the ceiling to this special place that I went to. The whole world I found myself in was engulfed in a very warm, brilliant light.
The bright light that so often accompanies near-death experience to a neurologist means that the visual system has been very strongly activated. There are many ways to activate the visual system, and among the strongest is REM consciousness.
Christine's awareness of these heavenly realms is classic. Near-death experiencers often describe realms that are beyond earthly in their beauty. They often use the term heavenly realms.
It looked similar like Earth, but all the colors were much brighter and friendlier, absolutely beautiful. And the ground felt like cotton, very soft and warm. I know this because I wasn't wearing any shoes. I was wearing this beautiful, long, pale blue gown. I thought that was strange because I didn't own a dress like that.
We couldn't get her heart going again. Medication and electric shock didn't work. All hell broke loose. We had to switch to manual heart massage. But we just weren't able to restore any circulation. I remember I even begged God to help us because I thought we had no chance to save this young girl.
Oh, good. That's what you want your doctor to be doing, is begging God for help. Okay, so basically what you just heard there is a very typical near-death experience. I've heard that story, almost identical, that story, many times on many different, you know, documentaries, Oprah specials. So that's the typical near-death experience, being levitated out of your body, being able to see everything going on in the room, the white, bright light, the feeling of comfort and warmth and purity and goodness and all that stuff. Well, but you also heard it being explained away by scientists and neurologists and whatnot. And so that's a little, you know, probably disheartening for the mystics in us. But there are some parts about it that don't quite add up to me. For example, when they're talking about being like in the dream world and that kind of explaining the part where they're lifted out of their bodies and can see everything going on in the room. Well, I don't understand that, because when I was sleep paralysising or sleep paralyzed, whatever you want to say, I said, I could hear what was going on. I couldn't see because my eyes were closed. These people are, you know, they're dead basically. Their eyes are closed. How could they see what was going on in the room? None of that made sense to me. And there are a lot of other things like that that I don't quite understand, and I don't feel the science is quite explained. But I found this this case. This is a brain surgeon, a very strict scientist, pragmatist, agnostic, realist, talking about his near-death experience. It's very fascinating because he spent his whole life and all of his career being one of these scientists and pragmatists who wrote near-death experiences off as totally explainable. Every single part of them has a logical reason that it happens and whatnot. Then it happened to him and his tune has changed completely. Here's a brain surgeon talking about his own near-death experience and how it changed his life completely.
You know, before this, I'd spent 20 years in academic neurosurgery. I thought I had a pretty good idea how the brain works and how it generates consciousness. I'd heard occasional near-death experience stories, and I was certain that there would be some brain explanation.
Eben Alexander is a Harvard-trained neurosurgeon. He put his faith in logic, in rational thought. Then in 2008, he spent 7 days in a coma. Now, he's a believer.
As a neurosurgeon, has this experience changed your thinking about life?
It has totally changed everything about my thinking.
Most people have some idea of what happens when we die. If you do indeed believe in heaven, it usually involves white clouds, bright lights, mountain tops. Well, Dr. Alexander is a man of science and of medicine. Well, he says he's been to the other side and now he's back to tell us what it was really like. What you saw or what you felt is God. Is that your definition?
Yes.
Were you a man of faith before this?
Before my coma, I had no belief whatsoever in a personal loving God.
Adopted as a baby, Eben grew up in a conventionally Christian family.
If you had asked me before my coma, how much would a patient who was extremely sick and should have died from a severe case of bacterial meningitis, how much would they remember? I would have said nothing. They would not remember a single thing.
That all changed when this life-saving surgeon suddenly found himself facing his own mortality.
November 10, 2008. It didn't really start off as being very good, did it?
No, it was basically like being struck by a freight train. Woke up at 4:30 in the morning, had severe back pain like nothing I'd ever felt before. It was a very severe meningitis, and the CT scans showed that it coated my entire brain. There wasn't any part of my neocortex that was left unscathed.
For 7 days, Dr. Alexander was in a coma. He was all but lifeless, completely unconscious. Yet he experienced a consciousness that defied all his years of medical training.
Here was this beautiful melody. And this light spinning closer and closer, it opened up as a portal into this gorgeous realm that was verdant, waterfalls, colors indescribable, and millions of butterflies flying through, a very ultra-real scene. And then there was a warm breeze blowing through that was like the breath of divine.
In the hospital, his doctors were losing hope.
My physicians were telling my wife that basically she'd be raising our sons alone. My 10-year-old son, Bond, had heard that, realized it was very bad news, came running into my room, pried my eyes open, and, "Daddy, you're going to be okay. Daddy, you're going to be okay. Daddy, you're going to be okay." As if he said it enough, it would make it true.
So your son was calling you back.
I had to come back. I had to claw my way up out of that very deep hole and somehow do whatever was necessary. He was pleading with me.
On the seventh day, against all odds, Dr. Alexander awoke. By medical standards, he made a miraculously quick recovery. But nagging the doctor was how to explain what he'd felt and seen.
Was it just a fantasy before death? Was it your brain basically telling you you're about to die and it's a nice way of shutting down all the systems and making it a pleasant way to exit?
Well, it's very important to remember that I had a severe bacterial meningitis that had greatly damaged and destroyed my neocortex, the part of our brain that makes us human, the part that allows for any kind of conscious experience. So that with that amount of destruction, there was no way to have a dream, a hallucination, a fantasy, a confabulation. Those things could not occur because that part of my brain was gone.
It was one vivid image seen by Dr. Alexander that finally convinced him that what he'd experienced was real.
There was a beautiful girl beside me on the butterfly wing. I can remember her face so perfectly, these sparkling blue eyes and light brown hair and this loving smile, and she never said a word, but her thoughts went right into me. You are loved. You are cherished dearly forever. There's nothing to fear. I knew her face so well, but I'd never met her in my life.
This is the woman Eben saw. Her name is Betsy. After Eben was adopted, his biological parents went on to have more children, including Betsy. She died in 1998. They never met, and it was only after his coma that the family sent him this photo.
And it was the very same girl who had been on the butterfly wing. And her face in the picture was almost mocking me, like, do you finally get it? I saw things I couldn't understand, couldn't explain, and I figured someday there would be a brain-based scientific explanation. Now I know there's a much easier, simpler, more straightforward explanation. That is that our soul is eternal, that our spirit lives forever.
Okay. Oh, so that's a cool story. That's a crazy story. I mean, I do take exception with one part of it, I have to say. I wish they hadn't said this part, because frankly, it kind of hurt. It kind of marred it for me, and for I'm sure a lot of people who have experienced something like I have. The part where he says his son ran into the hospital room and said, "Daddy, you're going to be okay. Daddy, you're going to be okay. Daddy, you're going to be okay." And he basically had to find it within him to do what it took to get back here to the living earth. Well, that bothers me a little bit, because I can tell you, when I was 12 and my dad had a heart attack and dropped dead next to me, I was saying the same thing. I mean, I would have given anything for my dad to make it. And frankly, my dad would have given anything not to leave us. I was the youngest of five kids. He had five kids that he loved very much and wanted to be here for. He had a wife that he'd been married to for 20 some years that he had no intention of abandoning. So the idea that a child missing them and loving them and wanting them to stay would be able to bring them back, that bothers me a little bit, because it's almost offensive. It's almost like, well, did we not love our dad enough? Of course, but that's personal. I don't mean to make it personal. The other parts of the story where his scientific analysis was defied, well, take that as you will. I don't really have any judgment on this. I think I stick to what I said earlier about my word hope. I know what I hope happens. I can't say I believe anything, really. Now, before we kind of move on to a new topic, that was about as mystical and as, you know, kind of what we all hope happens as it gets. And yes, he was a doctor. Yes, he was a scientist. But, you know, that was a very kind of hopeful interpretation. Here is Neil deGrasse Tyson, who's basically like a modern-day Bill Nye the Science Guy. He's basically like America's science teacher. He was on Larry King's talk show, and Larry King, who has been very open about his desire to stay alive forever and never die, and he fears death and whatnot, he asked Neil deGrasse Tyson for basically a scientific explanation, and Neil deGrasse Tyson gave him one. And yet, it's remarkable, because you don't think of scientific explanations for things like death to be very moving. But this was. I found this very moving. Here's what Neil deGrasse Tyson had to say about what happens after we die.
Okay. You're the scientist.
Bring it on.
You accept facts. Facts and belief. I know the religious people believe. The scientist says prove. What do you believe? What do you think happens when we die?
Well, so I can make some
unassailable statements about what happens when you die. So you spend your life eating food. Food has a calorie content, and calorie is a source of energy. Calorie is a unit of energy. You bring it in, and then the energy is available for you to maintain your body temperature at nearly 100 degrees. It's 98.6. How do you keep something at 100 degrees when nothing else around you is? You're burning energy to sustain that, because biologically, we need to be at that temperature to function, okay? You also need energy to walk and to move. That's why you eat food. The moment you die, what happens? You don't maintain the energy. Your temperature drops. How far does it drop? To room temperature. At a funeral in the casket, if you touch the hand of the person in the casket, your first thought is, the body's cold. No, it's not. It's room temperature. But it's cold compared to 100 degrees. They're no longer burning this energy. Okay, so now, every one of your molecules has energy within it. If you get cremated, that energy gets released in the form of heat. And you heat the air, and that air radiates to space. You get buried, which is how I want my body to be disposed of. Bury me. Bury me. Because you know why? I don't want the energy content of my body to just get radiated out into space, of no use to anybody. Put me in the ground. Let the worms, microbes, come in and out of my body. And the energy content of my body that I had assembled over my lifetime, consuming the flora and fauna of this earth, my body then returns to them. And thus is the cycle of life. I know that's going to happen, because you can measure where the energy goes. And that's how I want to go out.
But you're not conscious, and that's for eternity, right?
There's no evidence that I have any consciousness of anything. And by the way, is that so weird? Did you have consciousness before you were born? Were you saying, how come I'm not on Earth? My gosh, I need to be on Earth. Or where am I? No, there's just the state of non-existence. Oh. And so I'm not given any reason.
Yeah, but now I am born. Okay. And I can't stand the thought of non-existence. See, I already have existence. I accept it.
Okay, it is true. We fear death because we are born knowing only life.
Right.
I get that. However, I take another view, because I've been asked, if you could live forever, would you?
Yes.
Okay. Yes. No, okay, sure, that's an attractive idea. But the way I look at it is the knowledge that I'm going to die that creates the focus that I bring to being alive. The urgency of accomplishment, the need to express love now, not later. If we live forever, why ever even get out of bed in the morning? Because you always have tomorrow. That's not the kind of life I want to lead.
But why? Don't you fear not being around?
I fear living a life where I could have accomplished something and didn't. That's what I fear. I don't fear death.
You don't fear the unknown?
I love the unknown. I love the... You know what I want on my tombstone? My sister has this in her notes, because in case I can't tell anyone after I die. On my tombstone, a quote from Horace Mann, the great educator. Be ashamed to die until you have scored some victory for humanity. That's what I want on my tombstone.
But you don't fear, or...
Larry King just can't get it through his head. But you don't fear not being here. I'm here now. I want to stay here. Freeze my body, freeze my brain, bring me back. All right, Houston, you're on the air.
That's beautiful. I mean, isn't that true? Think about it. If you had forever to live, if you knew you had forever, you always had tomorrow, what's the motivation to get up and to accomplish something? It's true. I mean, that's a very interesting, beautiful way to put it. I love it. I love that. You're listening to The Next Best Thing on Radio Free Brooklyn. We've been discussing death. And then what? What happens after you die? I don't know. You don't know. We don't know together. All right, well, we're just about out of time for this week, friends. I hope you've enjoyed our show about the afterlife, death, and what happens afterwards. No real answers here because we will never know until we get to that point. Hopefully not for a long time for all of us. Now, the Next Best Thing usually lives on the leaderboard when it comes to iTunes listens. The podcast versions of our episodes are very popular. What can I say? And they usually get a lot of listens. And we're always among the top five on our leaderboards from here at Radio Free Brooklyn. The past 2 weeks, we haven't been on there. And that's unacceptable. So please, for the love of God, listen to all of our shows, all the past shows. Tell a friend, tell a relative, tell an enemy. Spread the word, write a review. Go to church. I don't know. Please spread the word because we need to be back on that leaderboard. That's where we live. And we're not too good for our home. Until next week, remember, friends, apathy is the enemy. Apathy is the enemy. Whether it's the news, the afterlife, your friends, your family. Care. Have an opinion. Stay informed. Stay up to date. Take some action and perhaps even make a change. For Radio Free Brooklyn, this has been The Next Best Thing. I'm John Lerner. Good night, folks.